One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This episode contains distressing themes and descriptions of violence. This podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener caution is advised. There is a timeless saying that bad things happen in threes. Some believe the superstition originates from the wartime phrase three on a match, which refers to three soldiers using the same match to light a cigarette. It was said that the light of the match would be seen by an enemy marksman, and by the time the third soldier lit their cigarette, they would be shot by the gunman who had them in their sights. While there is no scientific proof to support the notion that tragedies continue to happen three times in a row, there are certain stories where the belief rings true. Welcome to Season 9, Episode 9 of They Walk Among Us, a podcast dedicated to UK true crime. The headlights of Robert Long's lorry cut through the dense fog that hung over the A41 road between Bicester and Aylesbury. It was already dark on the evening of December 3rd, 1958, and Robert and his friend Hughes were on their way to a nearby farm to make a delivery. A familiar sound emanated from under the bonnet, followed by a steady hiss as the radiator began to boil and overheat. Robert knew the lorry wouldn't make it to the farm unless he cooled it down, so he pulled in by Heath Bridge just outside Blackthorn and climbed over a stone wall to reach the River Ray. The river runs from the River Thames through Wiltshire. As Robert approached the riverbank, he saw something awful. The body of a heavily pregnant young woman. Her brown hair was matted with blood, and she was lying flat on her back in the shallow water surrounded by rushes. Before running off to alert the police, Robert had observed the area. He noted there were no footprints in the thick mud on the riverbank. He later said, "It is very strange how the body got in that position." Officers from what was then the Oxfordshire Constabulary arrived at the scene shortly after Robert Long raised the alarm, and a 30-yard cordon was set up from Heath Bridge to the spot where the woman's body was found. The victim had sustained severe facial injuries, making it almost impossible to tell what age she was, but the investigators estimated she was no more than 30 years old. She was fully dressed, and it looked like she had worn her best clothes. A dark blue dress, a yellow cardigan, black court stiletto heels, and a dark grey coat. The nails on her fingers and toes had been carefully painted with bright carmine nail polish, and her ring finger had a thin gold band. A monogrammed handkerchief carefully embroidered with the letter T was found floating in the water nearby. As frogmen scoured thick vegetation 1 foot below the water's surface, teams of policemen conducted fingertip searches of the rushes along the riverbank. They were told to look out for the victim's handbag as well as anything else that might be of evidentiary value. At the time, the investigators were not sure if the woman had been murdered at the scene, or if she had been accidentally struck by a car and dumped beneath Heath Bridge. Floodlights were set up to allow the searchers to continue working in the foggy conditions and to enable the pathologist to view the body in situ. Dr. Derek Barrowcliffe, a Home Office pathologist working out of the West Midland Forensic Laboratory, accompanied the body to Radcliffe Infirmary in Oxford for the post-mortem examination. He found injuries on the woman's thigh and chest that were consistent with her being carried while she was still alive. Multiple teeth had been knocked from her mouth. Others were chipped and jagged. Finger marks on her face suggested that someone had held her from behind as they struck her in the head repeatedly with a blunt object. The blows were inflicted with such force that they fractured her skull and distorted her features. Dr. Barrowcliffe concluded that the severe head injuries had caused her death, and she had been in the water for around 24 hours by the time she was found. Detective Inspector F.J. Pettit, head of Oxfordshire CID, initially led the investigation. When the woman's description did not match anyone in his jurisdiction, he asked for the assistance of Scotland Yard. The victim was likely 8 months pregnant, but there were no records of women in local hospitals that would help identify her. As police dogs and their handlers searched 17 miles of grassy verges along the A41, investigators inquired at nearby US Air Force bases at Upper Heyford and Bicester Garrison. A description of the victim was published in news articles, along with information about a laundry mark found on her white cotton underskirt. One senior police officer remarked, "She was quite well dressed and obviously took very good care of herself." In the early days of the investigation, it was speculated that the murder could be linked to the unsolved deaths of three women in the wider area. 19-year-old Dutch au pair Mary Creek had been found beaten to death near Colchester in January 1958. That same month, the body of 17-year-old Anne Noblet, who had gone missing a month earlier, was found in the woods in Whitwell in Hertfordshire. It was believed that her body had been refrigerated for weeks before it was dumped. 2 years earlier, 35-year-old Diana Sutty was found strangled in Leverstock Green, Hertfordshire. Reporters made tentative links between the murders and dubbed the killer the Beast of the Roads. On December 5th, an 18-inch iron bar was found tangled in the weeds on the riverbed. It was taken to the forensic lab for analysis, and in an effort to identify the victim, her fingerprints were taken and compared to those on file in surrounding cities. The prints matched a woman who had been picked up by the Metropolitan Police for solicitation a few days earlier. The 20-year-old was known to frequent Hyde Park in London, but her family were from Wolverhampton. Officers made contact with her father Harold, who was too unwell to travel to Oxford, but his son made the trip and positively identified the victim as his sister, Margaret Brindley. Margaret was one of nine children born to Harold and Margaret Brindley, who went by Maggie. The family lived on Granville Street in Wolverhampton. Growing up, Margaret had been generally regarded as a quiet homebody, who preferred staying in to read a book rather than going out with her peers. She worked for EverReady for a time, before finding employment as a bus conductress with the Wolverhampton Corporation. Margaret was very close to her parents and siblings, but in her late teens she got a boyfriend and began to change. Her father Harold said, "My nice, quiet daughter suddenly went haywire." Margaret had a baby when she was 18 years old, and soon after placing the child up for adoption, she decided to move to London. She worked in a cafe and a services club, but eventually started sex work to earn money. In August 1957, Margaret got a lift with her friend Tony to visit her father in hospital. Harold recalled, "I had told her that because of the life she was leading, she could never come home to live. If she had changed, I would have forgiven her, but I could see no chance of that." A few days later, Harold heard that Margaret returned to London and her younger sister June went with her. She had been living in a three-story terrace house on Liverpool Road in Islington at the time. Harold told a reporter for the Sunday Mercury, "A murder is a shock, but not a surprise. What has happened to Margaret should be a lesson to other girls." Margaret's mother Maggie had recently separated from Harold and was living a few miles from the family home in Wolverhampton. She did not find out about her daughter's death until she was in a pub on December 6th. When Maggie learned what happened, she collapsed in the arms of her friends. Maggie said, "I expect she was making her way back to me if she was in trouble. In the last letter I had from her from Islington, she said she was going to be married. She was always a headstrong girl. I never thought it would come to this." The murder inquiry was led by Detective Superintendent William Baker of Scotland Yard. After learning that Margaret had been in Islington, the local police spoke to people she knew. Investigators made several press appeals to anyone who saw something suspicious on the A41 between Aylesbury and Bicester on December 2nd or 3rd. It was theorised that the killer could have used the heavy fog to conceal their movements as they dumped the body beneath Heath Bridge. Margaret had last been seen on December 1st. She had been arrested in Hyde Park the previous night and fined for solicitation. Margaret had been seen handing money to a 21-year-old Turkish Cypriot man she lived with named Ayub Jalal, also known as Tony the Turk. Jalal had come into Islington Police Station on December 3rd offering information on the men in the area who he said were living on sex workers' money. The police officer on duty dismissed him as he felt it was unusual for an informer to just present themselves. A few days later, when the police realised Jalal was the man who had been seen with Margaret, they tried to trace him. They didn't have to wait long, as he arrived back at the station when he heard he was being sought in relation to Margaret's murder. In an interview with Detective Sergeant Ashby, Jalal admitted that Margaret was his girlfriend. He said, "I know the girl. She used to live with me, but I don't know anything about murder." He was asked when he had last seen her. Jalal replied, "About 11 days ago, I took her to the railway station as she was going to her mother in Wolverhampton to have the baby." D.S. Baker had arrived at the station during the interview, and the police knew that Margaret had not left Islington before December 1st. Jalal asked if the police were sure the dead woman was Margaret, and when it was confirmed, he cried, "Only three people know about it. Margaret, she is dead. God and me. I will tell you all about it when I have seen my solicitor." Jalal was shown a photograph of Margaret's body, which prompted him to clench his fists, put his hands over his heart and say, "Nobody kills a person before they really hurt a person." The interviewing officers asked Jalal if he meant that Margaret had done him harm, but he refused to answer any more questions. Ayub Jalal was charged with murder at Bicester Magistrates Court on December 8, 1958. The former cafe owner appeared in the dock wearing a light grey jacket and dark trousers. He was remanded into custody as the police continued to collect evidence to support the case. At a committal hearing in January 1959, prosecutor Price Jones said that Ayub Jalal had been living in Britain for a year and had run a cafe on Liverpool Road. He lived with Margaret Brindley, who was a sex worker pregnant with his child. Jalal had claimed to have been with a woman called Dorothy Johnson on December 2nd when it was alleged that he killed Margaret, but Dorothy told the police that he must have got confused with another day they spent together. Dorothy said that she had met Jalal, who she knew as Tony, while waiting at a bus stop at the end of November. He had asked if she wanted to get coffee together, and she agreed. Afterwards, Jalal inquired if she wanted to come home with him, but she declined the invitation and kissed him goodbye. When she got out of his car, Dorothy saw him wipe the lipstick from his face with a handkerchief embroidered with the letter T. A lipstick stain on the handkerchief found close to Margaret's body was consistent with the brand worn by Dorothy. Dorothy Johnson's testimony had been delayed for a number of days while the police tried to locate her. When they eventually tracked her down, she said that she had been threatened and warned not to testify. Dorothy alleged that she saw Jalal again on December 3rd at his house in Islington, where he offered her a pile of baby napkins. Following appeals for anyone who had seen a pink and white Vauxhall Cresta in the days before Margaret Brindley's body was found, three witnesses came forward to report that they had seen the distinctive car being driven at speed along the A41. A cyclist who had to pull up sharply to avoid being hit identified Ayub Jalal as the driver of the car. Jalal had taken a lease out on the Vauxhall Cresta 18 days before the murder, but he had thoroughly washed the interior and exterior, including the boot. Despite claiming he had never left London, the vehicle's odometer showed that he had travelled almost 1,000 miles. A forensic examination of Jalal's car revealed traces of blood, and during a search of his bedroom, investigators found a map of the Bicester area beneath his mattress. A man who knew Jalal testified that he had seen him sawing an iron bar at a garage on December 1st and identified the iron bar found at the murder scene as the one he saw. The iron bar was a piece of a steering column that had been cut down. A voice in the garage where Jalal was seen created marks that were identical to the marks on the bar. There were also traces of green paint on the iron bar that matched the green paint on the door of the house where Jalal and Margaret had lived together. Traces of blood found on the weapon were the same blood group as Margaret's. The prosecutor told the magistrates, "All the evidence points to this man being involved in this crime, that he took the girl to this spot in his car and killed her with the iron bar." Joan Lyons, a sex worker who often saw Margaret in Hyde Park, said that two men had threatened to cut her up if she testified. A number of witnesses had to be placed under constant police protection. Ayub Jalal was accompanied by an interpreter in the dock and frequently leaned forward as witnesses testified. Tom Hudson, the chairman of the magistrates, admonished Jalal's counsel and said, "The only person who seems to get any enjoyment out of this, unfortunately, is your client. Having regard to the serious nature of the grave charges against him, it seems to us a little unseemly he should be wearing a permanent grin and smiling at his interpreter." When Jalal grimaced at a witness, the chairman said, "I do not know whether the accused is trying to attract the attention of the witness, but I wish he would conform to the manner in which he should behave." After being told to sit back, Jalal muttered to himself but continued to stare at the witnesses. With the evidence stacked against him, Ayub Jalal was committed to trial and pleaded not guilty. The trial began at the Old Bailey in February 1959. Prosecutor George Baker QC told the jury, "This woman was killed in circumstances which you may think denote the utmost brutality. She was slaughtered." The Crown alleged that Ayub Jalal had killed Margaret Brindley when he realised she would be of no use to him, having profited from her sex work for a year before she got pregnant. George Baker QC added, "Here was this girl, pregnant, not going to be able to go out soliciting for a time. This man required money for his Cresta installments and was asking other prostitutes to join him. It may be the time had come when this girl was no further use to him. There are 13 points of evidence which point irresistibly to this man." The prosecutor compared Jalal's handkerchief being left at the scene to someone leaving a visiting card and said that the T likely stood for Tony, the name that Jalal was known by. Referring to the defendant's alibi, which had been disputed by Dorothy Johnson, the prosecutor went on to say, "He has told the story of his movements and actions, which were in substance the actions and movements of a different day." Jalal's counsel argued that there was no direct evidence linking his client to the murder. The barrister said, "There is nothing to connect that handkerchief with Jalal except the evidence of Dorothy Johnson, who has been proved to be lying. She was a prostitute, and prostitutes lived in conditions in which they wanted to please the police. It was not beyond belief that when Superintendent Baker showed her the handkerchief found near the body, Johnson said Jalal had one like it." The defense counsel suggested that Margaret had been picked up by a lorry driver who brought her to the banks of the River Ray and killed her. During his own testimony, Ayub Jalal was confronted with the fact that Margaret's handbag and empty purse had been found during a search of his home. The defendant's account of Margaret travelling to Wolverhampton by train was not consistent with her leaving behind her personal belongings, and when asked if he had taken the handbag back to Islington with him after killing Margaret, he replied, "Go ahead and prove it." On March 2, 1959, the jury returned after 55 minutes of deliberations. They found Ayub Jalal guilty of Margaret Brindley's murder. Before sentencing Jalal to life in prison, Mr. Justice Donovan addressed the defendant. "The jury have pierced the network of lies by which you hope to confound justice and escape the consequences of this dreadful deed." Jalal showed no emotion as he was led from the dock. He requested leave to appeal a year later, but after a 15-minute hearing, the judges found that he had no grounds to appeal his conviction or sentence. Margaret Brindley's murder had a devastating impact on her loved ones, A murder was the second tragedy to hit the family in a seven-year period. In June 1953, Margaret's second cousin, 30-year-old RAF Sergeant Stanley Grafton, went out dancing at St. Peter's Square in Wolverhampton while on weekend leave from Hensford. While on the dance floor with his partner Janet Jobber, they were interrupted by 38-year-old John William Ayres, who asked for an excuse me dance, a dance where men try to cut in on a couple. Janet took the gesture in good humour, but returned to her seat afterwards. Witnesses reported seeing Ayres try to drag her to her feet for another dance, but she declined. When Ayres saw the couple leaving the dance hall later that night, he felt as though he was owed an apology and called out, "Excuse me, Sarge." Ayres later said that Sergeant Grafton turned around quickly and he thought the officer wanted to fight him. He shoved his hands up and went forward. I stepped back. I had no alternative but to smack him on the chin. Sergeant Grafton died later that night. At Ayres' manslaughter trial, Professor Webster, who conducted the post-mortem, told the court that the sergeant had a rather thin skull, and when he fell backwards after being punched by Ayres, Grafton fractured it on the road. Unfortunately for the Brindley family, bad things really did come in threes.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
James Campbell finished work just after 10 p.m. on Sunday, August 14th, 1960. Earlier that day, he had arranged to meet the woman he lived with at the Vine Hotel for a drink. Walking into the bar, he looked around for his partner's colourful headscarf among the punters, but he couldn't see her in the crowd. James walked back to his terrace bedsit on Dunstall Hill Road in Wolverhampton and saw nothing but darkness on the other side of the window to his ground floor bedroom. Usually the light could be seen from the street, and when he walked into the property, he expected to hear the sound of the television, but there was only silence. The Jamaican native was one of thousands in the Windrush generation who had come to Britain to help rebuild the country and the economy. The other residents of the bedsits had similar backgrounds and worked hard to send money back to their families. James had to force his bedroom door open, and as it finally gave way, he saw his partner lying across the bed. She was dressed in the grey military-style mac he had seen her wearing earlier, and she still had her black stockings and shoes on her feet. He thought she was sleeping at first. An iron on the bed prevented him from seeing her face. When he reached the side of the bed, he saw blood had pooled around her head, soaking through her brightly coloured headscarf. It was 10:40 p.m. when neighbours heard someone screaming, "Maggie's dead! Maggie's dead!" Forty-eight-year-old Maggie Brindley had lived with James Campbell on Dunstall Hill Road in Wolverhampton since she had separated from her husband Harold 2 years prior. Harold was still living in the family home 2 miles away on Granville Street, and when he heard of his ex-wife's murder, he said, "I thought I had all I could stand when my daughter was murdered. My wife left me about that time. When this is all over, I shall leave here and try to forget all about it." Maggie was devastated by her daughter's murder, especially as Margaret had planned to visit her and have the baby around the time she was killed. Maggie was consoled by friends she made in local pubs. Most days she could be found drinking glasses of bitter beer at the Vine Hotel or sipping on half pints at the Wellington pub. On the afternoon of Sunday, August 14th, the day she had been attacked, Maggie had a drink with James at the Vine Hotel before he started his shift, and then she made her way to the Wellington, which was closer to her home. She told the barmaid at the Wellington that she was broke, so the barmaid loaned her 3 shillings and 6 pence, which she used to buy a couple of half pints. Maggie, who had dyed ginger hair and wore thick-rimmed glasses, drank alone and was seen walking toward her home. A few hours later, she was found beaten to death in her bedroom. Maggie Brindley had sustained severe injuries to her head, neck, and throat. Home Office pathologist Dr. Hunt concluded that her killer had inflicted 14 to 15 blows with a heavy object. She had been struck with such force that her skull had been fractured and her throat was significantly damaged. There was also a number of crescent-shaped injuries above her breast and at the back of her head. Once it was determined that Maggie was the victim of a violent attack, a murder inquiry was opened by the Midland Crime Squad. Given the circumstances of her death and the fact that her daughter had been murdered less than 2 years prior, Scotland Yard investigators were also brought in to join the inquiry. In an effort to locate anyone who saw Maggie Brindley between 3 to 9 p.m. on the day she was killed, the police issued an appeal to speak with a Jamaican woman seen at the back of 27 Dunstall Hill Road where Maggie lived. The spokesman said, "She may have called to see the occupants, but it is important that we trace her and we ask her to come forward." There were no signs of a break-in or a struggle inside the ground floor bedsit, so it was theorised that Maggie had been attacked during a sudden argument. The killer's clothing would have been bloodstained in the aftermath of the assault, so investigators canvassed dry cleaners across the Midlands. No murder weapon had been found during the search of the home or the local area, and house-to-house inquiries turned up very little information about Maggie's life. Her daughter's killer, Ayub Jalal, was questioned in prison, but he was ultimately ruled out of the investigation. Factory managers in Wolverhampton were asked to provide the names of any employees who had unexplained absences around the time of the murder, and the police made sure to announce that their investigation was not confined to the black community, because Maggie lived with three Jamaicans. Detective Superintendent Davis said, "Hundreds of people have already been questioned, and by the time we have finished, we will have seen many thousands." Pub licensee Bill Pring, who knew Maggie as she drank on his premises, told a reporter for the Manchester Evening News that 2 weeks before her death, she had asked him to throw a Jamaican man out of the pub because she was afraid. Pring said, "After I put him out, he never came back, and he was a complete stranger to me." Maggie Brinley's funeral service was held at Bushbury Parish Church on the outskirts of Wolverhampton on August 22, 1960. A crowd of women and children had gathered outside, which drew criticism from Reverend Taylor during his eulogy. He said, "She died tragically and brutally. Some are here today out of sincere sympathy. I regret that there are so many sightseers here through morbid curiosity. We do not know what happened in Mrs. Brindley's closing hours, but we may believe that in her closing hours she turned to God for help." As Maggie's casket was lowered into the same grave where her daughter had been laid to rest 2 years earlier, women in the crowd parked their pushchairs between gravestones and craned their necks to get a better view. Maggie's ex-husband stood alongside five of their daughters and two sons. On the other side of the grave, her partner James Campbell stood weeping. Reverend Taylor called for silence over the murmurs from the congregation and told them, "This is one family, one of many in this country, mourning the loss of a loved one. I would like to think that most of you were here out of sympathy, not just morbid curiosity." Later that month, 1 week after an anonymous letter was received by the police, a man came forward with information about the murder. The witness said that his brother Eric Nicholson had vanished from Wolverhampton for 10 days in mid-August and then called him to say that he was afraid of the police. When they met up, he asked his brother if he had something to do with the murder, and although Nicholson nodded his head, he said no. Nicholson's brother knew he had lived in a bedsit in the same terrace house as Maggie Brindley, and they got on well. Nicholson would have been home from his job as a labourer at the time Maggie was attacked, but the police struggled to find a motive as to why the quiet man would have killed his landlord's partner. 45-year-old Eric Nicholson was arrested on August 28th, and when he was first brought into the interview room, he said, "I don't want to say anything." Nicholson did, however, begin to talk. His comments were peppered with religious references, and he told the police that he suffered from episodes of giddiness and shadows. A letter found in the property showed that Nicholson, who earned £6 a week with a supplementary 45 shillings from the assistance board, had loaned Maggie £5 in the weeks before her death. With a wife and six children depending on his wages back in Jamaica, Nicholson said that the debt had become a point of contention. According to Nicholson, Maggie had been sitting on a chair in the dining room where he was cleaning his shoes when he asked her to repay the money she owed him. He explained that she used an offensive slur, and walked towards her room. But he followed her and struck her in the head with the shoe he was holding. Telling officers what happened next, Nicholson went on to say, "You know, officers, she's a bad woman. I only went to her room for the money she owed me. When I asked her for the money, she argued and came at me with a knife. I lost my temper and used a shoe." Nicholson said he was unsure of how many times he had hit Maggie with a shoe, and added, "It appears to me as if the devil shadowed me. It was accidentally done because I have no grievance against her." Eric Nicholson was charged with Maggie Brindley's murder at Wolverhampton Magistrates Court the following day. At a hearing in October, Mr. Beasley, with the Director of Public Prosecution, said that Eric Nicholson was the only person who had the opportunity to kill Maggie Brindley on the evening of August 14, 1960. He added, "The prosecution cannot advance any satisfactory motive. Fortunately, we do not have to. It may be that a motive was locked in the mind of the accused." The injuries Maggie sustained to her throat, neck, and right side of her lower jaw were strange, and they did not appear to have been caused by a shoe like the defendant had claimed. Nicholson pleaded not guilty and was committed for trial at Staffordshire Assizes. The trial began on December 1, 1960. Mr. R. Cusack, prosecuting, told the court that Maggie Brindley lived in a property with James Campbell and two others, including the accused. On August 14th, James had come home from work to find the door to the bedroom they shared locked. He said that Nicholson had told him, "If you can't get in, you will have to knock the door off because she may be dead." During direct questioning from his counsel, Mr. A. King Hamilton, QC, Nicholson explained that when he asked Maggie for the money back, she said she had no time to talk before ending the conversation by being racially abusive. Nicholson continued, "I was upset. I lost my temper and hit her with my shoe. I don't know how many times I hit her." The Home Office pathologist Dr. Hunt said that the crescent-shaped injuries on Maggie's body could have been caused by the heel of a shoe, but other injuries were consistent with a heavier object. The defense asked the jury to return a verdict of manslaughter. It was argued that Nicholson had been so provoked by Maggie's offensive remarks that he was incapable of forming intent to kill her, which was something jurors had to be satisfied there was in order to convict him of murder. The prosecutor contended that there was not enough evidence to warrant a manslaughter verdict and urged the jury to find Nicholson guilty. After almost 4 hours of deliberations, the jury returned. While they found Eric Nicholson guilty of murder, jurors recommended mercy on the grounds that he had been provoked. Mr. Justice Pearson thanked the jury for their service, but reminded the court that he was bound by law to impose the only sentence available for murder: life imprisonment. So where are we now? Eric Nicholson applied for leave to appeal soon after his conviction. At the Court of Appeal on March 27, 1961, the defense argued that insufficient attention had been paid to the assertion that Nicholson was provoked. Before Mr. Justice Wynne, Mr. Justice Hilbury, and Mr. Justice Widgery, Nicholson's counsel said that his client had been a man of good character before the offence. In the ruling, Mr. Justice Wynn pointed out that the, quote, intense degree of provocation had been put to the jury during the trial judge's summation, and jurors had enough evidence to conclude that the correct verdict was murder, not manslaughter. The appeal judge also highlighted the fact that Maggie Brindley's death had been very violent. Eric Nicholson's application was dismissed. Thank you for listening, and special thanks to our patrons for their support. For more information on this episode, please see the show notes or visit our website, theywalkamonguspodcast.com.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.